welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in today. Well, I guess you don't really tune in anymore, do you? You're not tuning the knob here to listen to this show. So we'll say thank you for clicking in today. I'm Henrik Palmgren. I'm your host. RedIceCreations.com is our main website. It's been a absolutely crazy weekend here. We have some fascinating material coming up for you about the Charleston shooting. We are working 24/7 right now to pull together our report as quick as we can for you. We've found some vital details in this case, and also, more importantly, how this event is being used. So more on Dylan Roof and Charleston is coming here soon, folks. We also have another radio show on this coming up here with Jay Dyer next, so look out for that if you want to find out more. Well, today, though, we're going to touch upon something different. This was recorded prior to the Charleston shootings, and it is perhaps appropriately, or perhaps not, depends on how you view it. We have a program today about tribe and loyalty and violence, and the importance of getting familiar with violence, to not let that put everything on its head when it shows up in our lives, letting it control us in the way that it does. I think if we take the Charleston shootings at face value for what we've been told, then one of the lessons certainly is that violence can change everything, and it can show up when you least expect it as well. So beyond understanding the root of it and why it occurs, maybe it is important that we get familiar with it, not because we like it, but for the very opposite reason, because we dislike it, and that it's something we know how to react to when it shows up, so that we can protect ourselves and our loved ones against senseless violence, if you see what I'm saying. But that's a little bit later in the program. When we begin, we're going to talk about the loyalty matrix, and our guest is going to explain more about that. But Justin Garcia is our guest today. He runs a few martial arts academies in New York, and he is behind the Pressure Project podcast and the Jungle Gym Martial Arts Academy. A graduate of the New York City public school system, he's evolved to despise a few things: government schooling, excuse making, and the defense of mediocrity, amongst them. He's a married homeschooling father of three sons and one daughter, and he spends his time lifting weights, arguing with manginas, and embracing his ever-growing role in the creation of a new generation of warriors. Welcome, Justin. It's great to speak with you again. Thank you so much for coming on with us. It's good to have you here.
Henrik, it's an absolute pleasure. Great to be here.
Absolutely. Well, just a reminder for our audience here, you did a great program with Lana, Radio 314, and of course then you had me on the Pressure Project, your podcast, and we had a great conversation. And in fact, you have so much good material to share that I wanted to bring you on Red Ice Radio and kind of, well, pick up on this conversation of all the work that you've been doing and whatnot. And we have a number of important and very good topics lined up here today, Justin. But first, tell us a bit about your new series. I mean, you started, it's called The Loyalty Matrix, and tell us a bit why you wanted to do this, because there are so many things that we lack today. But I think most of it all kind of falls apart in our world because we have no real group. We have kind of a lack of identity, a lack of tribe, and all these things. Why do you want to make this series, Justin?
Well, I think being from New York, being in such a mixed, not diverse, so it used to be diverse, now it's just mixed environment. It's a topic that a lot of people, they leave sort of in the abstract. You know, what is tribalism? What is, you know, a group identity? You know, why should there be a difference between, you know, who our ancestors were and, you know, who our people are? And, you know, what I needed to do in order to deal with it, I needed to find a way to quantify it. I needed to find a way to actually create some sort of a logical process that I could figure out, you know, what is it that makes a group a group? You know, why is it that we feel comfortable with some more than others? And, you know, why is it that certain groups can't seem to get along? And, you know, and what are sort of the bits and pieces of what makes up, you know, this concept of identity? So the loyalty matrix was my way of sort of putting that on paper and trying, I guess, to add some math to it, the things that, you know, a lot of times we've taken for granted. And, you know, when you hear in, you know, in today's media's narrative, of how bad tribalism is and how bad, you know, thinking in terms of race can be. And, you know, I didn't buy it, and I didn't want to assign a value judgment to it. I really just wanted to dissect it. I wanted to be able to have a conversation about, you know, why a group is a group, you know, and, you know, what we could do to strengthen a group, you know, what's happening to a group that's making it weaker. You know, I wanted to put numbers and metrics on these things. I didn't want to think in the abstract. I didn't want to go by feeling and by, you know, what people felt was right. I really wanted to, and the reason I'd say that is because I didn't want to leave it up to somebody else's narrative to
right.
answer those questions.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no shortage of people, you know, just fighting to tell you who you are and how you should feel about yourself. And,
exactly.
you know, my, you know, the monoculture of today's, liberal, you know, plight is something that I wouldn't call moving from a multiculture to a monoculture. I would call it they represent a culture, and they're trying to basically swallow everybody else up to become a part of it. So even I think there's even a sort of we let them off the hook when we call what they're fighting for a monoculture. I would call it their culture. And I don't want to be a part of their culture. I like mine.
Well, exactly. And I think that's a good point because what I've found is that they use whatever they need, I think, at their disposal to just get to where they need to go, whatever their ultimate end point here is. They use, one day they call it, you know, multiculturalism or diversity, and then obviously their actions are contradictory to that, you know. So they don't really care about what you call it. They just want to get to you under their umbrella, if you will. But well, in our world today, I mean, do we need to, what do you mean with building identity? We can talk about that a little bit, because obviously there's a lot of identity and identity politics out there today. It's certainly a lot of offers out there. People adapt things like just a package. Actually, even the story about Rachel Dolezal is kind of an evidence of that, of how a white girl just, you know, pretends she's black because that's adopting an identity, right? So how do you approach that subject?
You know, it's funny because it doesn't take some sort of genius to figure out all the inconsistencies and hypocritical, you know, possibilities when you have a white girl from Montana saying she's black. You know, like, what about, you know, those things like affirmative action? What about those things that have been designed to empower one group over another? You know, is all we have to do, just say we identify with that group and then we receive the help, we receive the assistance. You know, it's just, this is what happens when you think in terms of this liberal progressive move towards their monoculture. You know, they will do, just like you said, they will do anything necessary to sort of achieve what they're trying to achieve. And that Rachel, I forgot how to pronounce her last name, but the Rachel girl is just the latest rendition of how just completely preposterous, you know, this is all becoming.
But isn't that indicative of something, though? Because obviously she, you know, we don't have to linger too much on this if we don't want to, but it's a good example. Right. It's a, you know, hot topic, if you will, right now, and people read a lot about it. But it really is indicative, I think, of the fact that she's choosing a different identity because she obviously lacks one, right? That this within, especially, I would say, Western culture and white people, Europeans in general today, there's a huge lack for a sense of belonging, of being part of a group, of having, I mean, sure, everything's kind of upside down today with, like, you know, these victim hierarchies and victim groups and things like that. You get something if you belong to one group versus another. But at the root of this, I think something it's really rotten to the core, where people, you know, they tried different things. They switch back and forth between different groups and identity just because they have no base loyalty at the root of things, if you see what I'm saying, Justin.
Right, absolutely. And you know what? With the Rachel case, you know, you see how it is that, because the people that know it's not right, the people that know that there's just something like this is not acceptable. Like to so many people, it seems obvious. You know, this girl is white. She's from Montana. How is she identifying as a black girl? That is completely ridiculous. But I would, you know, I would counter that, you know, if you are going to be of that mindset that this is wrong, this is inappropriate, then you better also believe in the power and the sort of validity of tribe and ancestry and folk and people and you know, where we come from. And because what happens is, and this is how I explained it to a couple of my students a couple of days ago, you know, if I'm a basketball player, right, and the professional basketball players play in the NBA, and if I buy a uniform for a team in that NBA, it doesn't make me a player on their team. So I could look like a player, I could dress like a player, I could buy their very uniform. It does not make me a member of their team. There are other qualifications that establish who is a member of that given team. Well, when we talk about the black community, you know, if all we need to do is get a fancy hairdo, you know, braided hairdo, get a tan, and hang out at the NAACP building, if that is all it takes to be black, then being black is not much.
Exactly.
But I would say, just like the opposite, if we had a black girl who would, you know, maybe she's fair-skinned or she used some sort of makeup or, I don't know, stayed in the closet for 10 years, and she developed a fair level of complexion of skin, and she dyed her hair blonde and she dressed white, whatever that is, you know, we would also say that she's not a valid member of the group she's trying to portray herself a member as. So we know at the core that there's something more than just the appearance. There's something more than even the superficial rituals and the things that people do. We know that there are links that cannot be fraudulently simulated, you know, and that's why we know that the story of, you know, Rachel, her case, we know that there's something wrong there. In my loyalty matrix, we would look at what it is that she's doing. And we would say that her identity is that of somebody who superficially is impersonating a black person. But to say that somebody is actually a person in the community that she's trying to be a part of requires her to have other components. And, you know, the loyalty matrix is made up of three components, and these are the three things that we look at when we're describing an identity. It's RPS. The R is ritual, procreation, and survival. So ritual is what it is that we do, what it is that we are. It's what it is that sort of gives us the ability to say that we're a member of one group and not another. Procreation is the means by which we add to our group, and survival is the means by which we prevent our group from losing members, right?
Yeah.
So historically, warriors have been part of the survival component of a tribe. They make sure that, you know, none of their members die in a war, you know, in one example of an application. So when we look at the case of Rachel, she can do only a limited number of components of the ritual. She cannot add to the group, and she cannot help survive the group or make sure that the group doesn't lose its members because she is not fully a member of the group. So when you have somebody that could simulate being part of a group, only at a very superficial level can they say that they are part of it. So when we look at her and the white community, whether she likes it or not, she's white. Whether she likes it or not, if people, just because she's claimed to be black, as much as people of the white community may not want to be around her right now, nobody would argue in the white community that she's still white. And I'd say that's at the heart of, you know, what the point of contention is, you know, amongst critics. So even though she doesn't want to be a part of a certain group, we all know that her desires do not make it so. There is something more there. There's something that transcends what our free choice is when it comes to what people you belong to.
Justin, I mean, this used to be so natural. This was part of the survival mechanism, all the things you mentioned of ritual, in other words, to kind of a bonding together with those in your group, procreation to survive, to ensure its future, obviously, and then survival. Without there's nothing of it. But, I mean, we've largely lost all of these today, exception of procreation. Well, to a certain extent, it depends on how you look at that, because demographics are changing radically too in certain areas. But, you know, nonetheless, it's like, how would you think that we lost something that was so fundamental and basic to human nature and survival?
I think it's akin to, there's a lot of different ways we could illustrate this. If I took a bunch of different predators, you know, different types of animals, and I put them in a sectioned off, closed area where they all had to deal with each other. What you get is you get conflict. You get eating other animals. You get other animals sort of becoming submissive to more dominant animals. And eventually everything sorts itself out. If it were businesses, if you had a small town that had, you know, 10 different restaurants, and each restaurant was vying for a limited marketplace, they would start attacking themselves through their marketing, through the operations and the rituals of their businesses. They would try and vie for a lion's share of the pie because that is what their individual tribe's survival mechanism is composed of. So what we see now is we see a bunch of different cultures that are thrown into the mix, forced to deal with one another. It only becomes a logical conclusion then that we are slowly going to be eaten apart from inside and out by more dominant tribes.
Right.
Now, when I say dominant, you know, my ego makes me explain what that means because I don't mean weaker or stronger in that sense. What I mean is they have less ritual, less standards, less requirements, less specialization. So it is easier to be a part of that tribe over another. So when you have this multicultural experiment going on, every single individual culture has a whole slew of unique characteristics. But when you throw all of these cultures in together, they could only deal with each other in the realm of commonality, which means the huge component of each individual culture is no longer palatable in that society because it is not shared amongst all the groups. So what you wind up doing is you wind up sort of taking the legs out from each individual culture by forcing all of them to deal together. Not side by side, but together. And that's what they're trying to do now with this liberal progressive narrative that we see in this country. It only makes sense that, you know, why is it that, you know, we can't say we're proud to be white? Well, we can't say we're proud to be white because it is not palatable by the other groups, even if those other groups have absolutely nothing to do with us. You know, so these commonalities is what we're reduced to. And it is impossible to maintain who we are as individual groups when only able to function in the level, at the level of commonality, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's the recipe, if you will, that you're talking about is largely seen as barbaric or old or, you know, not sophisticated. But I think that's a lie. And I don't know if I'm going too, I guess, too deep into the question right now. But the question is if, what has happened to us, Justin, of where we find ourselves currently and the confusion and the lack of ritual and procreation, survival, etc., that this has happened because it actually benefits someone else's survival. In other words, it is a kind of a strategy of sorts to try to, you know, control many different groups, at least in the Western world, but this is largely spreading to the entire Earth right now. But Is it our responsibility? Did we let this go, or do you think someone else has done this to us, and we've kind of they are now dominating us in effect?
Well, it's a funny question because I deal with it quite frequently, and a lot of people don't, you know, they're not very welcoming to my assessment of it. I believe that ultimately we're responsible for our own survival. We're responsible for our own autonomy and self-reliance. And the minute we assign blame, even though we can assess the causes of these situations, there's nothing wrong with that. But as soon as we assign blame, I would argue that we assign responsibility, accountability, and that sort of that handicaps our approach to fixing the issue.
Right.
So are there powers and entities and groups even that would like to see the demise of, let's say, you know, European culture? Absolutely. Absolutely. And there always has been, you know, but ultimately it is going to be up to us to become powerful enough in our own right that we are able to withstand that, you know. And, you know, when you talk about RPS, you know, ritual, you know, if, and I'm going to use the European example because it's one that we share, if we have European rituals, you know, are we performing them? You know, do I identify with them? Are we teaching our children these things? You know, is the identity of what it is to do being a European man, is that being shared? You know, do members of our groups understand what that is? Are they trained in the ways of being a European? Aside from that, when we talk about procreation, you know, are we raising our children to marry Europeans, to marry people who are going to have their grandchildren look like their grandparents? You know,
yeah.
Is that something that's discussed? And as much as I will say it's certainly exclusionary in nature, it's certainly not prejudiced or supremacist or, you know, because I say I love me, that does not mean that I hate you.
Exactly.
So are we teaching our children to love themselves, you know, or are we letting another group define that love as hatred for other groups, right?
Exactly.
So survival now, you know, when we see people straying from preserving this identity as a European, you know, are we having conversations with them? Obviously, you and I are a different species because, you know, we attack it at a level that most people, you know, don't even have the ability to.
Yeah.
You know, but the average, you know, the average experience of the average individual, you know, are you having these conversations? You know, I all the time, you know, I have a very mixed group of students here at my school, and I empower each one of them to embrace their individual identities. You know, we share an identity here at the school at a level of a martial arts family. But I make no bones about the fact that I am not black. I am not Asian. You know, I am not a member of the Hispanic community. My father is from Puerto Rico, Italian through ancestry. You know, I had a struggle growing up that I wouldn't wish on anybody. You know, and here at 40 years old, as I start to sort out, you know, the direction of my family, you know, I am here willing and sort of chasing people, you know, to have the conversation where these things are concerned, because I think it is of the utmost importance. And I think if we have individuals in 2015 that don't find it a very viable possibility that there will no longer be Europeans, you know, in 100 years from now, I think it's scary. And I think once we're at that point, everybody's going to realize that we fucked up.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't agree more. Now, so it's obviously one part of this is to learn to obviously appreciate or love who you are and whatever group you happen to find yourself to be in, that's something you accept and work with that. But is it also more about renewing these aspects? I'm particularly thinking about ritual here, because that's a huge component that I feel that we've lost. I would tie in, I guess, a notion of our history maybe into that as well. But is it something that needs to be not only brought back, but kind of renewed in our times to make it interesting? Or what do you mean with ritual, Justin?
Right. So with ritual, you know, I break it into two categories, customs and traditions. Customs are the things that we do that are unique to the people that we share the experience with right now. So maybe it's, you know, if you are in Japan, you know, to say hello, you bow to somebody. If you are in the United States, you know, we shake hands. There are different things that we do that are individual to our groups that happen right now. If you are a Christian, you make the sign of the cross. If you are a pagan, you know, or a Asatrur or Odinist, maybe you have, you know, a Mjolnir pendant, you know, or something that is unique to you right now. Tradition are customs that are woven between the generations. So traditions are what allows us to connect the people who came through the links of time before us with all those links that are going to follow. Those things are customs that are a lot more powerful, a lot more survival-based through time. You know, you may have Europeans who share a European experience that is contemporary, maybe with the music, you know, the individual songs and music groups that are on, you know, that they all identify with and they share amongst each other. But then there may be those customs that are old, those customs that were started in times way before they were, and they know and they feel the obligation to pass those things on to the next generation. You know, we may have religious-based ceremonies that we're going to teach our children that our parents once taught us, whereas we may not expose our children to the individual music groups that we may have listened to as members of a certain group. That makes sense.
Right.
So the whole thing is, when you look at the loyalty matrix and you say an identity is based up of RPS, it obligates us then to explore, develop, and cultivate and maintain those rituals as a group. If we don't practice being a member of a group, the group becomes weaker and weaker. We have to do the thing, right? So I remember having a conversation with my father and on being a Puerto Rican, you know, and he said, well, you know, in Puerto Rico, we say if your parents are Puerto Rican, you're Puerto Rican. And I tell him, well, you know, I wasn't raised to be a Puerto Rican man. I don't speak Spanish. You know, my father married a Irish Italian woman. You know, I was never close to that culture. I visited the island once. You know, so the ritual of being a Puerto Rican was non-existent, you know, to me in my childhood.
Yeah.
And I explained to him, it's not a choice. It's really a sort of an internal dialogue, an internal conversation that leads to an identity that exists even on a subconscious level. You know, so the rituals I did embrace, the rituals that did seem natural to me, weren't that of, you know, of Puerto Rico or, you know, my more, you know, Hispanic lineage. And it's just that was a product of both the customs of today, but also the traditions that I've been introduced to and exposed to of my ancestors, you know, that have come before me. So if we don't practice doing the identity becomes weaker. And everybody should feel, no matter what group you are a part of, an obligation to uphold that.
Exactly. So how did you navigate that on a personal level? Did you, you know, find and seek this out later in life? And, you know, if so, was that something that kind of set you back? Because I can just speak for my own part here. And I realized that it took me many, many years to kind of navigate through all the trappings of popular culture and everything else that was like competing for room, if you will, of seeking customs and traditions, right?
Right. It was certainly something that I struggled with early on. It was probably the source, the most major source of conflict internally, as an adolescent, as a young adult, for me. And, the big thing was, I was not a part of one group. So I would get rejected by both groups. And, you know, with the European side of my family, and the Puerto Rican side of my family, both of them being somewhat folkish in nature, you know, individually, it's not something that I found at the time very, very comfortable or convenient. But over time, what it did was it forced me to find the answers to these questions of what it is to be a member of one, as opposed to the other, and how we can't be, you know, bearers of multiple flags. That's not the way it works. I'd be an American, a Canadian. You know, my wife is from Brazil, and she, you know, loves her Brazilian family and her native country. But she's also, you know, 90, 92% European. And that, you know, it brings in another component. you know, it got to the point in my life where I wanted to know, you know, what I was made up of. I wanted to know what was in this recipe of me.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, when I found out that I was 80% European, it was to me, a nod, of approval for what I had felt, sort of identity wise. You know, so once that's the case, you know, if I am somebody who believes in the metrics, the science, the almost a formula of being part of a group, it then obligated me to start pursuing, you know, well, what are the rituals of being part of this group? I had a long conversation with a friend of mine, Tom Kyer. He's one of my martial arts instructors, a very good friend of mine. And, he and I had a talk about the, you know, the Norse gods once and, you know, the way of the Vikings. And, you know, he and I are very privileged in that, we get to work with the military, you know, on certain occasions. And, you know, we're both martial artists, so we have things to share with them. And, you know, in the military, you know, the Norse gods and the mythology of the Northern Europeans, is very, very prevalent in what it is that they do and how they identify themselves. And it led me to explore, well, what are these customs? What were these societies of warriors that believed in so many of the things that I've always championed for? And it, as I explored these things, as I sort of developed a grasp of this information, it became sort of like an accelerated level of understanding and identity building. And now, you know, now I'm at the point where, I do, you know, embrace those gods and that mythology as the framework by which I design my morality. It starts getting complicated. And, it is a good thing, you know, but it all came down to me finding out, well, you know, what is it that I'm doing? What is my ritual? I'm doing something every day. Well, who is it that I'm being? Is that person a part of a group? I know that being part of a group adds a synergy that one cannot mimic individually. So I know being part of a group is the thing to do. But now what group am I doing as far as being a member? Beyond that, it became, well, what group are my children going to belong to? Because now when we look at the procreation aspect of the RPS formula, well, I'm going to make a group stronger with my children. What group is that? And then when it comes to survival, well, who am I identifying my family as? Am I preserving the identity amongst them so they can embrace the rituals and the identity of the group that I'm choosing for myself? So this became a very significant journey for me and my family, and one that has always been based in strength. But without this loyalty matrix, would have been much more of a struggle, and I feel I would have been lost in abstraction, you know, at every turn, because there are so many things that you just have to be pragmatic about, you know. And I remember a couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine that I had grown up with, a black guy, came into my office, and, you know, he listens to the Pressure Project, to my podcast. And, he said, it was actually funny. He, came in and said, you know, Justin, I need to talk to you. And I was like, oh, what's going on, man? I haven't seen you in a bit. And he goes, look, you know, in the neighborhood, we're all worried about you. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he says, you know, we all think you're becoming a supremacist.
That's funny. And, yeah.
And, you know, and what I did was he and I had a very productive conversation, and I basically just asked him to give me all the things that makes him proud to be black. And he, you know, he gave me a whole slew of things, and I took those statements and I just replaced black with white, you know, he spoke in a universal enough, you know, perspective that I was able to do that. And I said, you know, why is one different from the other? You know, and I like saying often, you know, just because I love me doesn't mean that I hate you. And, you know, we were able to come to a common ground of understanding. But at the heart of it, you know, people need to understand your journey is your journey. And when you are part of a group, you have obligations as a member of that group to help that group's survival. And the RPS formula is what I found to describe what that obligation is.
Yeah, very good. There's a lot more to this, of course. But it's a good point you mentioned there, too, and I want to kind of pick up on that a little bit, because it takes, not always, but in some cases, it kind of takes that, you know, peer-to-peer conversation, if you will, because there's a lot that stands in the way of people understanding, you know, tradition and belonging and why, just as you said, why love for yourself and for your own doesn't automatically mean you want to kill or, you know, maim others or, you know, dominate them or be a supremacist or whatever. I mean, but that's there as a barrier that separates understanding, and that's very unfortunate. And to a certain extent, I guess it doesn't matter what we do, because that kind of knee-jerk response will always be there. And it seems to me, anyway, that it's not until you actually take a person to the side and, like, really ask them, like, listen, what about what I just said is, like, supremacist? Or what is hateful towards others within what I'm saying? And I've done that with a couple of people here and there, and they never seem to define it or pin it down, but they somehow get the understanding still that when I speak like this about Europeans and my own people, then, you know, they're automatically triggered. They're like, this is somehow hateful, and you're not allowed to do that. So that's a big hurdle, isn't it?
It is, and it's one, you know, when we talk about those in everybody becoming part of their culture, this is the narrative that they promote. You know, they promote this victim mindset. I'm a huge fan of Friedrich Nietzsche's work, and one of the specific pieces that he's worked on or written about was master morality versus slave morality. And slave morality is defining oneself as a reflection of another people. So without the master, the slave does not know how to think about himself. Whereas master morality dictates that we define ourselves completely in terms of ourselves. So we do not need another group to sort of be there to compare ourselves to figure out how we feel that we are valuable or invaluable. So with the weaker groups of society, it is all too easy for them to blame the rest of society for their woes. And for me, you know, my reaction, my rebuttal to so many of these people who claim that, you know, one group over another group is holding them back, holding them down, preventing them from seizing opportunity or from even having opportunity in the first place. You know, I point to those members of their group that have somehow defied all of these, you know, overwhelming, you know, odds that they're describing to be successful anyway. And I also question their commitment to their own group's power, you know, and, you know, it's usually, oh, well, I figured you guys would be stronger than that, you know, and it's not something they don't want to embrace the identity of being weak, the identity of being a sort of victim-minded people, but everything that they do illustrates that. So for me, it's very easy to look at my people, who I consider my people, and tell them no other group matters when it comes to who we are as a group. We have to define ourselves in terms of ourselves at the core of who we are. As soon as we say that we're doing great because we're doing better than them, what happens is we're only limited to being slightly better than another group. So the very non-PC way I say it is, you know, we don't want to be the tallest midget. You know?
Right.
You know, so when we compare ourselves to other groups of people, we're limiting and really disconnecting from who we are as a people. What I like to say is that every group has its own potential. Every group has its own ladder, its own journey. And, you know, we all have universal concepts individually as different groups that we can apply to our own journeys to make them as powerful as possible. I always talk about the scene in the movie Conan the Barbarian, where Conan and his Mongol companion, Subutai, are sitting on a hill talking about their gods. And now here you have two men from two different tribes or two different belief systems basically busting each other's chops, but at the end of it laughing and continuing on their way. Because each of them so strong and so sort of confident and complete in their identities that the power of one doesn't threaten the power of another.
Right. Yep, exactly. I mean, sure, as you said before, there are groups that are working to gain advantages and whatnot, but, you know, at the end of it, nonetheless, at the end of everything, it's like the Greek philosopher Epictetus said. He said, you know, circumstances don't make the man, they only reveal him, you know, that shows, okay, what character are you? Are you going to take up this challenge? Are you going to realize that the pressure that's going to be put on you is something that ultimately, if you can come through this, it is going to make you stronger. And it's all about what we do with those, with that circumstance that we're faced with, right? That's what we need to realize, that it shouldn't be something that holds us down, that makes us weaker. It should make us even more motivated and make us want to fight it and make us come through that, right?
You know, absolutely. At the end of the day, we're just going to be what we are, and what we are is what we do. So, you know, should we assess, explore, and investigate what those factors are that are stacking the odds up against us? Absolutely. But at no point does acknowledging them absolve us from the obligation to actually do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, there are plenty of other groups. You know, I talk about the marriage, you know, like I tell my students all the time, you know, you're black, you should marry a black girl. You're white, you should marry a white girl. You're Asian, you should marry an Asian girl. And I say this openly and consistently. So, you know, I'm not scared of non-PC conversations. And I'm almost losing my effect because people are starting to get used to me, right? But the thing is, if you have a group that is saying, you know, you should marry within, you know, your group, and that empowers your group, how that somehow is skewed into being a message of hate for another group is completely just a weak-minded reaction to a very manipulative narrative. And it's to the point now where I, as much as I embrace my European identity, I embrace the rituals that come from these, you know, these cultures that have come before me. I also understand that when I deal with other groups, I cannot deal with them in a manner that is going to sabotage their own plight for a master morality. So it's hard for me to complain about somebody thinking like a slave when I am treating him like a slave, when I'm telling him that I have these aspects of who I am and my people, and we are going to be strong, and we're going to not rely on anybody else, you know. But look how terrible your group is, and, you know, you guys are different because you're not capable of doing this, you know. And I think it's in this day's society, it's an approach that I don't feel is going to be the most effective one. I think we need to push for the narrative that it is okay to be proud of our group. It is okay to be proud of who we are. It is even okay to do what it takes to preserve our group's identity. But I think too many people that are on sort of this side of the discussion go a little bit far beyond the point of diminishing returns, and they allow themselves to become these extremists, these supremacists, these, you know, they basically define themselves, you know, in terms of the other group,
right?
Which
yeah.
is getting back to what I think led to this problem in the first place.
Yeah, well, exactly. I've said that for a long time. It's all about what we do and our relationship to the world, not according to what others do or not do or what have you. That's all it's about. It's about us and our journey, and that's what the main focus need to be. And I think that's one of the reasons, as we've said now, that we've lost our way. It's because we've given up on this. And I mean, sure, there are things that are competing for our attention. I mean, let's talk about the children a little bit and your suggestion how to bring this to our kids, you know, these customs and traditions, whatever they might be, whatever group you belong to. These are now at this stage competing with, you know, X-Men and, you know, magazine covers with the Bruce Jenner on it, you know, stuff like that. Things that are that might be very, very attractive to children. Do you think that somehow these traditions and customs need to be, you know, brought up into the modern world in some way? Or do you think that they, no matter how maybe basic and kind of rudimentary the storytelling of these traditions is, if that's sharing mythological stories with your children and whatnot, that they will be, they're still powerful enough to attract, despite that we can't present it like, you know, X-Men on the silver screen, if you know what I'm saying.
Right, absolutely. It's something that parents used to be relegated to in generations past because there really wasn't any option. Today, just like you said, you know, there is a competition for the attention of a child. I, for one, think that that too many parents these days opt for convenience. They opt for what amounts to other people raising their children, even though in person the child is with them. They don't understand what, you know, what happens to a child that's allowed to sit in front of a television for 5-6 hours a day. A child that's passed off and handed to a government institution for 8 hours a day, taught by strangers who have absolutely no loyalty to who you and your folk are. All these things are sort of taken for granted. And too many parents think that the occasional holiday, the occasional family get-together is going to be enough to battle that in the identities of their children. And, you know, I, for one, don't think that's the case. I would say that I'm a product of that. I grew up in such a sort of mixed exposure culturally because my parents were from different folk. You know, they had the same thing that I was, you know, that I would criticize a multicultural society for. They were reduced to their commonality, and there wasn't enough, you know, in that, in my upbringing, in my home culturally, to have me identify as one or the other. So I think that all of those sort of voids need to be filled by the parents proactively. There, sure, there was a time where you were surrounded by nothing but your people, and everybody performed the rituals of your people. But this is a new era. Now we're at an age where every single generation of every single group needs to be fought for. And it could only be done proactively. It could only be done by designing, actually sitting down, take the abstract out of it, think nuts and bolts, you know, rubber on the road. What are we doing every single month to reinforce our group's identity? You know, whether it's, you know, visiting, you know, countries of your ancestors, it's practicing the religion of your ancestors, it's studying the mythology of those people, you know, that came, you know, from times past. You know, my family, the bulk of my family identifies as a Catholic. And, you know, I had a conversation with my mother a few months ago where I'm telling her, you know, well, you know, we've been Catholic for less than 2,000 years. You know, we've been, you know, of more natural, organic, folkish, you know, religions for 40 to 50,000 years. You know, why is it that we're sitting here thinking that we are not a member of that group and we're fighting for, you know, maintaining our membership in this one?
Yeah.
You know, and how is anything valid if, you know, we're only going to be reduced to defending the latest link on the chain? How strong is that chain to begin with? You know, and when having these conversations, you know, you start to realize that it is so important to acknowledge the entire chain, you know, in order to maintain the strength of it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned that. And obviously there are also so many correlations, you know, with both Central and Southern European traditions to the Northern traditions. I mean, many of them seem to share this kind of proto-Indo-European root where, you know, in some cases you just have to swap out the names and you basically have the same thing. And unfortunately, as you said, Christianity removed a lot of this. And I think one of the reasons we still have a lot of knowledge about the Norse way is that much of it was written down and preserved due to it being Christianized so much later. But, you know, there is a common root there. And certainly there are many differences. I'm not saying that, but there is from a mythological perspective, there is a story I think that you can pick up on in the Proto-European root of things. And that's why I think it's important for all people to look at this root. And just as you say, this is very, very recent that we have our way of life. I mean, Christianity, to a certain extent, has been with us for a while now. But everything that's happening in the modern world, my God, that's a blink of an eye in the timeline. And we are heading out here on a limb, if you will, where we have no idea where this will go. We haven't lived like this probably ever by giving up on our traditions, by giving up on our roots, and yet it seems like we're expecting that things are just going to improve and get better, but I'm not so sure that's the case, Justin.
I have a saying I use a lot. It says, it's always easier to fix a boat than it is to calm the sea. And when it comes to how we're going to deal with this, it is always going to be empowering who we are in our identity. It's only ever going to be us becoming stronger in what we identify as, you know, who we identify with, and proclaiming that and preserving all of these rituals and all the things that make up, you know, the label of what an individual group is. Now we, you know, when it comes to, you know, my particular journey with my family, you know, when it comes to Christianity, I had always identified as an atheist. I never identified as being somebody who believed in the metaphysical in a general sense. But when it comes to rituals and identity, and, you know, even if for nothing more than a sort of archetypal, you know, relationship with these myths and customs, you know, I've always looked at Christianity as having come from a land that I don't have family from. My family is not from that land. You know, my ancestors, you know, were not at the beginnings of these, you know, these myths and these legends and these customs and these rituals. These are identities of other people. This started coming to light with me. I remember here in the Bronx, I went to Catholic school until I was in fifth grade. And there were, you know, as a Catholic school, there was a huge religious component to the curriculum. And I had a good friend of mine. His name is J.O., Korean kid. And I used to always ask him, you know, does it bother you that nobody in any of our books looks like you?
Right, right, yeah.
And his answer was, nah, I don't care. You know, like, I go to school because my parents tell me to. But something was always unsettling about that, how so many people, different types of people, were just so willing to sort of worship, even to the level of worship, these groups that had absolutely nothing in common with who they were and where they came from. It was pretty much, you know, anything that makes you you no longer counts. It no longer matters. This is the story. This is the script. Like an actor showing up for an audition in a play. You know, this is who you're going to be from now on. Here are your lines. And I always felt like religions from other lands was that. It was somebody handing you a script and saying, this is who you are now. And I think it's a disservice. You know, it's easy to say we love our parents. We love our grandparents. But when is the last time you asked yourself, how many generations does it take before you stop loving your family? You know, where is it supposed to end? Is it only the family that you've met? You know, if your mother died in childbirth, are you not to love your mother because you've never met her? You know, so, you know, it's very easy to say, you know, I love my father, I love my grandfather, I love my great-grandfather, but when does it end? When does that person in that line as we go upward, when do they begin to become like everybody else to you? I would argue, I would campaign for never, because they're all part of the line of our history. They're all part of who we are as a family, as ancestors. And to have anybody come to us and say that that no longer matters should be offensive to you. It should be something that you defend. It should be the thing that allows us to activate our group's survival mechanism, you know, if we're thinking in terms of the RPS.
Absolutely. I mean, this was a given. I mean, not too long back, you know, and I'm surprised and amazed and I wonder, and you know, that's why we do so many shows on this too. We're trying to get closer to, you know, what happened? How did we lose that and how do we get it back? Because it's so important to our survival, you know. But let's pick that up and talk a little bit more about that, Justin, in the second hour. We're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes. I also want to speak more about, you know, tribe building, how we approach that in these times, pressure to power lifestyle, and, of course, building a relationship with violence as well. I'm very interested to hear more about that. But I want to talk about the Pressure Project a bit here, too, and help you guys plug that. I mean, I did a show with Justin a while back talking more about Sweden and some of my personal journey, I guess, that you guys can check out. It was a really good show, and Justin asked some great questions as well, by the way. But tell us more about the podcast, and if there's anything else you'd like to give out, if there's anything with your, you know, classes or how people can get a hold of you, Justin.
I appreciate it. Yeah, the Pressure Project is a podcast that I started a little over a year ago, and it was really it was designed to help men become powerful enough to have powerful conversations. I feel that so many of the things that we're suffering from in our society today are products of men being weak and men not embracing, you know, what masculinity is and what our obligations are, you know, as men. And it's really to men that I speak to on the podcast, and it's really, you know, finding ways for them to, you know, maybe a little bit more methodically, you know, I try to not leave things in the area of abstraction where we go on feeling, but methodically, you know, what are the formulas for becoming better men, becoming better at being men? You know, that is what the podcast is about. And wherever I see weakness or the rejection of strength, you know, I try to go and explore and have a show. And it's why I had you on about Sweden, because in Sweden, they're fucking up, Henrik.
Oh, they are. We speak about that all the time. They're a good example of what not to do, yeah, for sure.
Yep.
All right, very good. Yeah, give us the URL and how people can find the website and all that.
Sure. It's thepressureproject.com is our main site. The Pressure Project members is our membership site, a little bit more behind the scenes on the members site. But we put out 3 episodes a week. We're pretty prolific in that sense, and everything's available on the regular site, a lot more archived stuff and extra stuff on the member site.
All right, great stuff. We'll have the links up, ladies and gentlemen. But, it's a very important work that you're doing over there, and thank you for doing what you're doing, Justin. But we'll take a short break here, and we'll pick up in the second segment. Stay with us, everybody. Well, ladies and gentlemen, hour number two is coming up right after a short break. We'll get into the topic of understanding and getting familiar with violence, not because of the useless glorification of it or the senseless application of it. Quite the opposite, to know how to deal with it when it arrives and what we can do. As I said in the introduction, this was recorded before the Charleston shooting, so perhaps it is a bit prophetic considering a few things that Justin will share with us. But in the second hour, we'll begin to discuss tribe building, finding our kinsmen, getting fit, ancient virtues, pressure to power, lifestyle, and also homeschooling. To catch the second hour and all our programs in full, plus videos, films, insight episodes, and more, sign up for a membership. It's only €5 per month, and that's about 5.5 US dollars at today's exchange rate. You can sign up for a 3-month recurring or a non-recurring subscription. We also have 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, or 2 years non-recurring. So try it out. I'm sure you'll find a lot of interesting programs in our archives. We'll be back with Jay Dyer about the Charleston shootings, and then we're working on our own in-depth video about the subject as well, so more coming on that. For now, we say thank you for listening and for watching. We'll be right back with our second hour with Justin Garcia. See you on the other side of the break.